listeners. You are listening to another episode of Beckett's Babies, a playwriting podcast. On the show, we discuss plays we love, interview theater artists, and share our thoughts on playwriting and theater. We are your hosts, Sarah Cho.
And Sam Collier. And today, we are so excited to have as our guest, Rebecca Ware. She's a freelance director and dramaturg with a focus on new play development, as well as an assistant professor in performance, play, and design. And Rebecca and I met all the way back in the dusty history of our undergraduate years. So speaking of memories, we like to start off with asking our guests, what is your earliest memory? So, Rebecca. Mm-hmm. What's the first thing you remember?
In life. Okay, great. Also, let me just say it's so great to be here with the two of you, and I'm really excited to be chatting with you too.
Oh, yay. Well, thanks for joining
us.
Yeah. And so hopefully someday we can all do it in person together.
Yes.
Snacks. So what is my earliest memory? You know, I was trying to think about this. I'm not sure what my earliest memory is, but I have a couple that I think that I might have made up, but I also might not have. Mm. One is that when I was little, my parents moved houses, and I remember moving into the new house that we were moving into, and I remember the walls being covered with plastic, like giant, you know, sort of like plastic sheeting, because I think that it had just been painted. You know, there must have been something about the timeline where we had to move in. And so I remember like walking into this new abode and being kind of confused and curious about this place, which sort of, you know, it was very solid, but it also felt like kind of ghostly in a way.
Ooh.
And I remember also what we had for dinner that night, because I love to eat, which was like a store-bought rotisserie chicken, carrot sticks, and a giant carton of milk.
Nice.
Yeah, which honestly, like, I could consume now for dinner.
Yeah.
So I remember like that as a memory of almost like a sensorial memory. And then I also have a specific memory of being young, and my sister and I both had pepes, or, you know, special blankets that were made for us with loving care by by our aunties when we were babies, and that we carried throughout childhood. And some of us, I won't give names, but some of us still have these pepes. I remember when I was like really young, I was so angry at my sister one time. And I think I was older than when we had first moved in, but I remember this was sort of like my first experience with probably like rage and shame that I can remember, because I remember being so angry at her that I threatened to cut off part of her pepe if she didn't do what I wanted her to, and she didn't. And I cut off like the tiniest little thread, but I cut off like a piece of her corner. And I just remember that like emotional maelstrom of like vindication, as well as like, you know, guilt and, you know, the poisonous miasma of shame and whatever else. And then the last thing I guess I remember is when I was really little, and we were in the first place where I was born, I remember this giant apricot tree, which frankly was probably not that giant. But I remember there was an apricot tree in the yard, and I used to go eat as many apricots as I wanted, like in the sun, in the summer. Mm. And there's something about that feeling of like open time and just endless bounty and like honeyed satiation, which I feel like I'm probably still trying to get back to. So
wow,
that's a panoply of options, but those are a few of my
what a great triptych
memories.
Of
I was just gonna ask, if was this all around the same age, same time period?
I have no idea.
There's
I mean, the apricot tree, I must have been really little. I don't know, maybe question mark 3 or 4. I don't even know when we moved, but you know, maybe I was like 5 and then or 6, I don't know. And then the pepe cutting, I don't know how old I was. I just remember the desecration is what we should call it, the pepe desecration.
And is your sister older or younger than you?
If it's not clear, she's younger.
Okay, that was my guess. And do you remember what you wanted her to do that she didn't do that resulted in this act?
No, I don't. But you know what? I should ask her because she has the memory of an elephant, and she probably does. She definitely remembers her pepe being cut, and it's not brought up often. It's like once every few years, but like it is in the still in like the, you know, relationship vocabulary. So she might remember why I did that, or maybe just come up with something on the fly. Who knows?
Wow.
Yeah. I want to ask you two about your earliest memories. I know that's you probably.
Well, there are that. Other episodes where we interviewed each other.
Okay. I can't wait to listen.
Those memories do exist somewhere.
Somewhere.
In the archive.
The ephemeral.
So, okay, this is great. So how did you go from this tiny child of many experiences and capabilities to getting into theater?
Well, you know, I think it's a couple of things. The first is that I couldn't watch television growing up. And so I read a ton. I was, you know, probably just about as well read in middle school as I am now, you know, at least in terms of like habit and breadth. And so I think that, you know, storytelling and like a desire to play with storytelling was probably interwoven into my earliest forms of play. Definitely was with like my siblings, you know, like just playing pretend in the backyard and making potions and whatever. And then the second thing that happened was there's an amazing couple up the street, a young family up the street of my parents, who decided to start this thing called the Boulder Road Players, which like, God bless Mark and Margaret. I cannot believe that they took this on, but they were like, we are going to make a, like a theater troupe for the neighborhood kids. And Mark, I think, was maybe an animator at Disney or something. And like Margaret was this incredible artist in her own right. And they just, over the summer, they decided like, we're just going to gather all these, you know, neighborhood tots and make something with them. And so.
That's so cool.
It's amazing. I honestly, I could not imagine myself ever taking that on. And so I, you know what I mean? I like am in awe. And the first piece that they did was a riff on Jack and the Beanstalk, or whatever that one is called, except we made it like Jill and the Beanstalk.
Wow.
Right? And I was Jill. And they put it up in their backyard. They like wrote, you know, they wrote the script. We like quote unquote rehearsed. And I remember they made this set piece, which was like a piece of fabric on rollers, you know, which essentially became the beanstalk that I quote unquote climbed. And so they unrolled, you know, this or sort of rolled across this piece of fabric, like on the back of wall of, you know, part of their, I don't know, garage or something. So you could see, quote unquote, like the beanstalk grow as I did this like miming climbing. And it just was so inventive and playful. And like, you know, all the parents were hanging out, loving it. And frankly, I would love to go to that show now, with my friends' kids in it, but I cannot imagine directing it. So, so yeah, that's probably like my first memory of theater.
Wow. Wait, so, and then, you said you played Jill? Is that what you said?
Yes. Yes. My starring turn as the lead actor. I played Jill.
Oh, so what was memorizing like? Like learning lines and learning cues and...
Yeah, you know, it's so funny because I don't remember it being that hard, but, you know, right now I'm directing at an educational institution, and for various reasons, it's a little bit of a process of like discovery, shall we say. And I had a stress dream about the production like earlier this week, but the form that my stress dream took was like me getting on stage as an actor. Somehow it had something to do with this show, but I didn't know the lines or the cues, you know? And yeah. So it's funny because even though like I am not an actor, I have like zero desire to be on stage truly. That kind of modality is still like an easy neural pathway through which to kind of like try and unconsciously or subconsciously grapple with this feeling of like not being on top of something or like, you know, being a little out of control with something or whatever. So
that's so funny. I mean, I have the same thing. I haven't acted in like, I don't know, like 18 years old. But I still have dreams like that where I'm on stage and I don't know the play and I'm like looking, I like run backstage and I'm trying to find a script. Like it's so weird.
I know, yeah. Right? You're like, how is this so deeply ingrained in my psyche that this is where my mind wants to go, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Sarah, do you have dreams like that?
Oh, stress dreams?
Like
about acting. Like,
yeah. About acting? No. No.
Nice.
What are your stress dreams about theater or anything related to writing look like?
I don't really have dreams like anything to do with theater. I don't think I've had dreams like that. I mostly have dreams like recently my most I was like in a murder. I was in a dream where I was caught between something and I was like, oh no, like I know who the killer is, but I can't let the police know this or something.
Oh my god.
It was just like and then it always transitions from like this really intense thing, then I go to the Disneyland or like I'm just like floating.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know.
And then you're in Disneyland and all the stress melts away?
Oh, no. It's so stressful.
Oh, okay.
No, it's like I feel like all my dreams, I'm always like in a crowd and I'm trying to get out of the crowd or I'm in a situation where I'm looking for something or someone or murder, like just protecting a murder. I don't know.
Wow.
Jeez.
I feel like in most of my stress dreams, I'm usually a spy that's like running through some kind of surreal maze trying to protect someone, you know? Sam, what are most of yours like?
I don't know. I mean, last night I had a really stressful dream about a spider that bit my dog and like, and I had been trying to make peace with the spider and let it live in my apartment.
Oh my God, stop.
Oh my gosh. Then my dog had this spider bite, and so I was like, okay, I've got to get rid of it. I don't know. That's the kind of stress dream I have.
Oh my gosh.
I woke up and I was like, what was that about? There is no spider.
Even your dream is like the natural world. Animals and like, my gosh.
Yep.
I love that.
Okay, so, and then. back to you, Rebecca. So did you do theater in high school, or how did you start getting into directing? What was that journey like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did theater in high school. I did, you know, I feel really lucky retrospectively. Now that I teach in higher ed, like I see how important it is to, if you're going to, we could use like the word entice or, you know, just encourage kids, mm-hmm. but I just see like how important it is for students in, you know, first grade to play like a mm-hmm. little bunny rabbit or something, you know, which just came out from my subconscious because I did that. But, you know, whatever it is to have that exposure and excitement early on. But anyways, in high school, I did theater at my, where I was in LA. And the theater was kind of intense. I mean, that I feel like is its own podcast, you know, like the theater teachers we have had.
That would be interesting.
You know what I mean? And I don't necessarily want to put anybody on blast in this moment, but there are some tales. I had a lot of fun with the sort of various productions that we did, I guess, but I also didn't. I mean, we were doing like All My Sons, you know, mm-hmm. and in like, I don't know, in high school, I just remember being so stressed about the fact that I had to like kiss a boy on stage in front of everyone as opposed to like, you know, being in, I don't know, like a plant costume as I should have been, you know, doing like Little Shop of Horrors or something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Anyways, but also, I know this is tangenting quite a bit, but also now that I think about like programming for students, it is quite challenging. So I understand, the navigation that can be. So anyways, but I had a lot of fun doing that. And I didn't do that like all the time. You know, I did it, you know, maybe like a production a year or something because I was also playing soccer and, you know, I don't know, doing volleyball, hanging out with people, whatever we did in high school, trying to understand AP physics, you know, all that stuff. And then I did college did theater when I got to college. I thought that it was just going to be for fun. And so I would always do theater as like my fun class, you know, so I would take like neuroscience and psychology and then a theater class or mm-hmm. environmental studies and, you know, history of women in the first half of the 20th century and a theater class, you know. And then at one point I tried to transfer universities. I did actually officially transfer schools. Realized instead I needed to take a year off from school instead of transferring. Mm-hmm. And when I came back, I I was like, oh man, I just need to graduate. I got to get out of mm-hmm. here. Which is funny because, you know, going back to Middlebury with you this past summer, Sam, I was like, wow, this place is gorgeous. You know, hindsight. So anyways, this is just to say that I was trying to wrap up my college degree and figure out what I was doing for my senior work. And one of my professors was like, well, Rebecca, why are you trying to act? You clearly enjoy directing more. And it was one of those moments where I was like, wow, somebody can see something in me that I can't even see in myself yet, you know? Mm-hmm. Which is one of the beautiful and kind of unsettling things about being an educator at times. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, you're right. I have so much more fun when I do this thing. And she was like, this aligns so much more with how you want to think about making work and the kind of work you want to make. And so that is sort of how I did it. But I guess that's the short, that's like the educational answer, you know, like the other answer is that I think it took me longer to self-authorize as a director, like professionally. And there was a good amount of trial and error, and like living in New York, and a bunch of other things that came before I really could kind of claim that to myself.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So you were living in the East Coast before moving out west? Is that what happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, I was in Vermont for undergrad. Then I came back briefly to LA. I thought that I wanted to be a documentary filmmaker, and I thought that reality television was the way to get into that. This was a different time.
Yeah, I remember this.
You know what I mean? Like reality television around, like, you know, the like end of the first decade of the aughts, you know, it just was like we just didn't have the same like critical lens, or at least I didn't at that point.
I mean, it was such a different time. So this is like what, 2010? I mean, it was like I can't even put my mind into what that time felt like anymore.
I was actually studying film, and then I got into school thinking I was going to be an editor, and then I was like, you know, editing documentaries, doing film, stuff like that. And then I was on track to be like, okay, I guess I was also getting ready to like work on a PBS documentary as an editor. Like I was on track to just graduate school and become an editor, especially because all this rise of reality TV shows. And I was like, there's ample of jobs.
Exactly.
I was like, but I ended up not doing that, and I don't know why I didn't do that. I'm just like, it's like a lucrative career. It could have been a lucrative career.
Wow. Sarah, that's so fascinating. Some part of you was just like, thank you, no thank you, and just changed your mind.
Well, I think it was the hours of just being in a dark room that I was like, I think I need sunlight and vitamin D. I can't be in this room and just looking at a screen for hours and hours and hours. And I actually took a theater class because I was like, I need people around me. Yeah. And that was sort of my access. I'm like, oh, this is theater? Oh, this is interesting. And then I got hooked.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how they get you.
Here's humanity. Here's
enjoy.
People. Yeah.
That's so funny. Wow. Sam, what were you – did you come into school knowing you were going to be a playwright, or did that sneak up on you?
No. I mean, I knew I wanted – I knew I loved theater, but it wasn't really until I took a – actually, you know what? I think it was my freshman year. I saw a couple of plays that fall and spring. This is before you came, I think. There was a zoo production of a Naomi Wallace play, and then there must have been a couple other senior – projects that I just was like, oh my god, I had no idea plays could be like this. And then I took a playwriting class and started writing plays and really fell in love with it.
Amazing.
Let's see. I guess, like, what do you love about directing?
So many things. I guess I feel like I'm always trying to chase like the perfect meeting point for where I can have the most fun, and I can also do something that feels like it actually has some kind of social or material impact. And directing is the closest sort of answer that it seems like it's the closest thing to an answer that I have. I don't know. I mean, I think I used to think about like directing for social change in a very specific way. And I think that's great and really important. But at the end of the day, I'm also just trying to find pleasure in life and to have fun as much as I can and as like responsible a way as I can. Mm-hmm. And sometimes this feels like the closest thing I can find that is like the nexus between those two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are there particular kinds of plays or projects that you are attracted to or you try to work on that help you do that kind of thing? That are like both pleasurable and kind of activating all those things you're interested in?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know, Sam. I feel like sometimes, but I feel like also, can you hear me okay? I know there's like a helicopter going past me. Okay. I know that also ultimately I just like bring my whole self to all the work I do. And so regardless of whether or not I try, those things pop up. So for example, I'm working on a piece right now that is about the mental fatigue of suffering. And I want you to think about it like The Office meets a little bit of the apocalypse through a Kafka-esque lens. And it's, it takes place in like a business office. It's a new piece by Preston Choi. This is the piece I'm working on at my school right now, but I'm also pitching it. So if anybody has any interest, please talk to me about it. It's called You Will Get Used to It. And, you know, a lot of it is sort of about this like endless cycle of bureaucracy that we find ourselves in that actually deceives us into thinking that we're creating material change, but actually stymies us.
Whoa. And,
but it's funny. But I, but I bring this up because we're trying to figure out our set. And so we're just pulling a lot of things from like the university surplus right now. And so I was just like, can you guys throw some rolly chairs for us like into the space? Can you just put some desks in while we like try to build this world? And the other day I was vamping because we didn't have all the pages. We had like a little script printing issue. And so I was vamping with the actors and I was like, we're going to do some exploration through chairs. And so I had them doing these like, you know, like, I want you to move across the stage in your rolly chair as if you've just heard a delicious piece of gossip, you know, whatever, you know, like classic sort of casual directing acting exercises to try and get people to think about like mood and pace and physicality and character and all these things. And I went home that night not thinking about it. And the next day I was like, oh, there has to be a scene, and there is a scene later on in the play where there are all these sort of like fast jump cuts between people. And I was like, oh, the answer is that I'm going to have to figure out some kind of game that everyone is playing and competing to win each night while they're on their rolly chairs so that we never know who's going to win each night to like keep the pace and the energy of that scene like as high as it can be, hopefully very safely. maybe like don't release this until like we finish and like nobody's been injured. But, you know, and then, and also that like breaks up the sort of like, you know, like dry deadpan, sometimes, you know, like witty nature of this, of sort of where the play is at that moment and like forces us into high gear. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that's sort of an
example. Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, that's really cool. Like,
how do we integrate play even where it maybe doesn't? Consciously.
Yeah, play and like, I don't know, I've been thinking a lot recently about precarity in live performance. The kind of, how do you, when you're creating something that you've rehearsed a bunch of times, but you're performing live, how can you hold on to that moment of not knowing what's going to happen next, you know? The liveness of it.
Yeah. A little Auslander reference. I love it. Yeah, I saw this performance of Roe at OSF. I don't know, whenever it premiered, like, you know, 5 years ago or something. And there is this one transition where okay, this is a memory. This is not the quote unquote truth, right? But according to my memory of it, there's one transition where all of a sudden characters have to become other characters, and they changed in front of everybody on stage, but they made it a race to see who it was that could change the fastest and then would like ring this bell, you know? And that idea of creating some kind of mechanism inside a play where it is a game that creates that like sense of the unknown for the performers and the audience, and like automatically raises the stakes, but in a way that's delicious, you know, I think that mm-hmm. I'm like chasing that too, you know?
Oh, I love that. Mm-hmm. Well, and the fact that it's not necessarily legible to the audience. I mean, that they know they can feel it, but they don't know where that feeling is coming from.
Totally. Yeah. I had no idea really what was going on, but I remember seeing people like laughing on stage and like racing to hit a bell and like kind of understand it. You know what I mean? But that delight, that like unguarded delight, I think is actually infectious.
Wow.
Sarah, do you disagree?
No. I guess it's, I think I mean, just hearing you and Sam talk about it, I was like, you know, I've done improv so many years, and I'm just like, I hated it. I hated I was like, no script whatsoever, and just going on.
But you
like
kept
this.
Doing it, so you must have loved something about it.
I don't know if I liked it, Sam. I think it was just like, it was just like, oh, all the cool people are doing improv right now, and I'm just gonna do it. And so I don't think I liked it. And
that can't be the only reason.
I think I just committed way too long to improv. But
I mean, you would like take the mega bus from Iowa City to Chicago to go to an improv class.
Because when you're like, a kid and you learn, oh, Tina Fey and Amy Poehler did improv in Chicago, I gotta figure what this is all about. Mm. You know, wow. It was just like,
but all along you hated it.
I think deep down I was like, this is so cringe. I hate this. I hate, like, ugh, God, I'm just tapping into what emotions for this? What?
I don't know. I wish we had 25-year-old Sarah Cho right here to.
I know.
So we could really ask her.
I think it was just like, yeah, I think I thought I liked it because there were moments that when it worked and it was fun, but that was like 1% that happened. 99% of the time, nothing worked, and I was like, this sucks. And I'm always going home so like disappointed.
Oh my God. Okay. I do feel like I have to couch what I just said in the fact that, like, you know, rare is it to find a piece where like that kind of like that insertion of a game is actually appropriate, you know, and like moves things forward. You know, it's not like I like find every piece that I work on and I'm like, what game will we play here? You know, but it just is, I do think that, you know, because I am like always trying to curate like every single moment and every single choice on stage, right? It's not like control, but to like, you know, like create a unidirectional around that we're all like running in, you know? There is something that can be very intoxicating every once in a while about like throwing your hands up and like seeing where everything lands for a moment, you know, before you jump back mm-hmm. into the, you know, the train ride or whatever it is. But I do feel like I have to ask Sarah, you know, mm-hmm. like every improv person kind of has a cadre of like go-to characters, whether or not they acknowledge it.
Yeah.
I need to ask, like, what is, you can tell us your top one or like your top three, but like what's one of the ones that you played a lot?
I think I always depending on the scene, I just played like somebody's wife that's just annoyed. I never liked leading a scene. I was always just kind of like adding on to the scene, so I was always playing like little side character or or like a duo, like a walk on. So I never really had characters that I leaned on. But if I was, but if my team was like, we're gonna make Sarah do something more than just walk on, then I just went nuts. I was just like psychopath or something. I'm like, oh my god, I just went berserk on stage. I was like, I would just run through the wall, and I'm like, and be like a really cartoony. So,
ooh.
But I don't know if I had like a character that I went to. But yeah, I know what you mean. There was always, people had a couple characters in their back pocket that they always played.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, Psycho Sarah. Yeah. That was me. That was Psycho Sarah.
Maybe Sarah, someday when we hang out in person, you can do a little improv for Sam and I.
A one-person show. Yeah, totally.
Okay, we'll look forward to it.
All right, back to you.
Okay.
You know, this conversation is inspiring me this question. So with all this news that's been going on with theater lately, like just left and right, I feel like theaters are closing or there's a restructuring happening and everything that's going on in the world. I'm so curious, Rebecca, like what do you think is your – what's your prediction about theater in the next, let's just say, 5-10 years? Like what do you see changing, or what do you see more stories being told? Like what's your prediction?
Oh, gosh. Wow, Sarah, I really wish that I knew or had an inkling about that. I mean, I think more theaters are going to continue to fold. I mean, I think the same thing that's happened with the economics of this country in terms of class are happening with theaters, and we're seeing like the winnowing out of mid-sized theaters for the most part.
Mm, yeah.
I think like smaller theaters are going to continue because we will always need a place to make work, especially when even if representationally there are gains in large theaters, there's still a specific sense of taste about what makes a good theater piece. And so I think that in some ways is shifting, and in many ways, again, it's like easy to deceive ourselves into a sense of change. So I think that smaller theaters are going to, will always be around. And I think that some of the larger ones will, you know, I read something recently, I can't remember which of the artistic directors at, Steppenwolf wrote it, but, or she said in an interview, she was like, we're not too big to fail. But I do think that, which was, oof, but I do think that some of the larger theaters will continue to get support. I mean, I think that we're seeing this generational shift in terms of like philanthropy, you know? And so that's kind of my question is, what kind of work can we make where people are just as excited to go see it as they would be to go see a concert? And I think that a lot of that work is in process, you know? I think that people are, they're, like immersive theater is nothing new. Like devised theater is nothing new. Site-specific work, like, hello, we're looking, you know, at the second half of the 20th century and earlier. So, but I think we'll probably be leaning more into those things would be my guess. Mm-hmm. And I guess the thing that I keep coming back to is, why are we so much more interested in going to a concert than we are sometimes in going to a play? Mm. And I think my guess would be that some work will move more and more in that direction. I mean, obviously musicals, but there's still this, musicals are so structured in many ways. Mm. I mean, I love musicals. I want to work on more musicals. But yeah, I'm curious about if work will move more in that direction. I don't know. I don't think I have any predictions. I think I just have like wonders, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And obviously that doesn't even get into like digital work and VR and I know so many people who are experimenting with really awesome things. Like, I was just talking to a video game director who also is a resident artist at San Francisco Opera right now. And she was talking to me about working on a piece where the brain-computer imaging from the audience gets translated back to the opera performer, and they end up modulating what they're singing in response to it. So I think there's tons of experimental, quote-unquote, form-forward work that's being made. And I, again, think that we will always need to have, like, small, intimate experiences. I think that's part of why people are loving, like, that this sort of turn from like stand-up comics into like one-person shows, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I'm hungry for spectacle, and I also think, you know, I don't know what's going to happen monetarily. So we shall see.
Yeah.
I want to ask the two of you this question too, but I know that,
It's your interview. Okay, this is great. Okay, so here's another question. Mm-hmm. Tell us some of your favorite playwrights. And if you like, you could also segue into naming three playwrights, living or dead, that you would love to have at a dinner party.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, I think that I really like plays that I don't always understand, you know, so, or that like on first read or first experience, like I can't tell you where they're going. I think that the, you know, one of the challenges of being a theater maker is that we're always thinking about story, especially when you do new work, you know, you're always like trying, you're sitting in the audience, but it's, if the play or the theatrical experience or whatever it is like anything less than top tier, like we go into our minds and start thinking about story instead of staying in the moment. And so I really enjoy reading work that I can't tell where it's going. And of course, the tricky thing, you know, is like as a maker is figuring out, how do I do that? Like, how do I keep this element of surprise while also leaving enough breadcrumbs so that the ending still feels emotionally satisfying, if not necessarily always like intellectually finessed, or still offers some set of sense of like satisfaction or completion. So, you know, like I'm always interested and excited to check out Jackie Sibley Drury's work.
Oh yeah.
You know, I really enjoy work made by Haruna Lee, or I'm always curious about it. You know, and then there's a bunch of course, I'm like thinking about, I'm like blanking on so many other people right now, but you know, I really am intrigued by stuff made by like collectives. It's like less sort of a singular vocality, but you know, I think like if I could hang out with some playwrights, I'd be pretty interested to, I've always wanted to go see Aryan Mnuchin's work, you know? There's this whole slate of directors from that time period whose work we could probably critique for using like very adeptly and probably appropriately using critical race theory or queer theory or all these various forms of liberatory thought. And also, I'm really interested in work made by people who were unafraid to still try and attempt some kind of comment on humanity or unity across identity, and to use a more labor-centered critique. So I'd love to see Aryan Mnuchin also because who doesn't want to go to that complex and see like what's going on, you know? I think it'd be like fun to have dinner with Artaud, but I feel like that's maybe about as you might want to go. You know, it's like, is he like super whiny and self-serving, or is like, you know, like would he be like, I am now going to do a reading for my play and like dessert, and you'd be like, oh my god. But then, or would he be like, you know, psycho Artaud and be awesome and like mime like running into walls? It could be super cool. And then like exploding into a billion vaginas, you know, we just don't know. So I think he could be really cool. I mean, I feel really lucky in that I, have gotten to meet a lot of sort of the stalwarts of Asian American theater. And so that's been really incredible. But I'd also love to meet somebody like Rosvita, you know, who...
Oh, yeah.
Just like...
Nobody's ever mentioned her really? As a dinner guest. I think this is a first.
Oh, my God. I just saw... You know what? I think I would have mentioned her anyways, but I just saw an exhibit about women in horror comics. Or no, it was like... horror comics created by or illustrated by women last night. And there was one that showed like a panel of nuns battling spiders.
And oh my gosh. Like,
how have I missed this comic? You know? Anyways. Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know. I feel like I'm giving a pretty Eurocentric perspective, which is lame, but I don't know. Those are some of the people that I would love to meet. I mean, there's so many like incredible East Asian directors, you know, that would be amazing. But I guess I'm thinking more almost, you know, more almost like playwrights. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of those folks have been lost to the black hole of history. So anyways.
Yeah.
What about you two?
You'll have to listen to
okay,
our
sure, sure.
episode
yes.
in which you're interviewed.
Great point. So appropriate. Okay.
I feel like you're one of our more resistant guests so to be interviewed. No, it's like kind of awesome. Okay, great. So I think we're kind of getting towards the end here, but what about any advice you would have for early career theater artists, maybe young directors who are just starting out? What would you tell them that you wish you had known?
I guess I would tell them... I don't know that there's anything I wish I had known, Sam, because I feel like you kind of come to the realization when you're ready for it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Because there are a lot of things that I knew, but I didn't really know. Or that if I had known them earlier, it wouldn't have mattered because I still wouldn't have internalized them.
Like what?
That like you have everything you need.
Yeah.
And also that just because theater in the US is based on a model that pretty much only allows people to freelance if they or to exclusively pursue like theater making if they have like outside support, you know, or like, and I mean like financial support, like that doesn't mean that you can't still make really interesting and curious work if you don't have that. And that's also like not an excuse to not make work, you know?
Yeah.
And also, you know, that being curious is always better than being like insecure or being jealous, you know? And also that like you know, you're always going to be afraid, so you have to do it anyway. You know what I mean? It's just like it gets like a little like
right.
banal, these like life lessons. But I guess I would say like I feel like so many of the things that I wish I had known are actually in common parlance now in theater. Like, we're talking about money a lot more. We're talking about who can afford to make work a lot more. We're talking about the challenges that caretakers have in theater a lot more. Mm-hmm. And not enough, but it's more, you know. We're talking about invisible labor and performance. And we need to keep talking about that. But yeah. I don't know. I don't know that I have like, oh my gosh, Bing Bing.
So cute. Bing Bing.
Also, get
that
a dog.
That is Rebecca's dog.
Yeah, that is a piece
get
of
a
advice.
Dog. Great advice.
That is a piece of advice I would give. Oh, I have a piece of advice. I would say like theater, if it's useful to you, you can think of theater as like a vocation, but you can also think about your theater role as like a role that you take on and put off. And that doesn't mean that like you're without passion or not committed. It just means that work is work, and it's okay for us. And we should have lives outside of it, you know?
Yeah. It doesn't have to be everything about you.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. I mean, I like to think that, I mean, there's so many more interesting things for all of us than, you know, just what how we spend our time sometimes, you know? Mm-hmm. Also, Reworking by Studs Terkel. Okay.
Sneaking that in.
Yeah. No, just a thought.
Yeah. I like that last thing you said about the role to play and just, you know, I just feel like definitely since becoming a mom and I'm like, my whole world now revolves around another being, like my child. It's just like, that's definitely like has shifted my thinking, like priorities and like time and like everything is just like, I'm now a mom. Like that's like a whole new identity now. And, and it's kind of like, how does being a mom now work in my current life or not? You know, it's just like now it's trying to figuring that all out and, definitely trying to keep him alive is a very important thing to do right now. So keep him healthy and alive.
Would they? Yes.
I think you're doing great so far.
Thanks. Doing my best.
I mean, it seems like it's a winning success, you know, if that's like if that's what we're here to do, then you're nailing it, Sarah.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. Well, pat on the back. let's see. Oh, so we'll move on to Glistens, but before we do, where can our listeners find you?
Great question. Do you mean like digitally or geographically?
Digitally.
Okay, great.
I guess digitally. I don't know if they'll hop on a bus to find
people are like, oh, I happen to be in this part, in this area, you know, okay, whatever.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah.
This is madness. I mean, ideally at dog parks everywhere is the answer.
Okay, that's perfect.
I saw somebody the other day, instead of saying like, I'm an LA-based artist, they were like, I'm a citizen of the world-based artist. And I was like, amazing. Yes. Great. I love that.
That's so 90s.
You know what? They're very back in vogue, Sam. So maybe
you're right. Everything old is new again.
When is Bono gonna do like another like giant red concert? You know, for like the world. You know. Oh my God. Okay, where can you find me? On my website, RebeccaWare.com. Wear like you wear your clothes. Wear like underwear. RebeccaWare.com. There you go. And it also links to my Instagram, which I guess is sort of the closest I get to like an active social media presence.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Should I talk about my glisten?
Yeah, we'll jump on to glistens. Yep. So this is the part of our show. We like to share our favorite glistens of the week. This can be new music you learned or maybe a news headline you found or just something, a new app or a new, just something interesting that just caught your attention. I guess I could start. I'll start first. My glisten of the week is I feel like I always talk about TV, but it's what I'm into. Okay. So I've been watching on Prime this show called Invincible. And it's an animation show, and it's very like anti-hero kind of. It's kind of like if you've seen The Boys on Amazon, it's kind of like that, but it's animated, and it's just, I didn't think it would be, at first it was hard to get into because I was like, I'm not really into animation like this, like superheroes, but the storytelling in this is really good, and I'm enjoying it right now. And Gen V, which is another Amazon Prime show, which is a spinoff of The Boys. Jesus. I really hate Marvel. Like, I hate DC Comics. I don't like the superheroes. But I feel like what Amazon is putting out is, like, very anti-Marvel. And I like it. It's like an antidote to all that horrible commercialized superheroes that we've been seeing the last 20 years. So... that's all. That's my listen. Sam?
I recently, you guys know I don't watch a lot of stuff on Netflix, but I recently, for some reason, decided to watch something on Netflix, and I watched this film called The Swimmers. Have you seen this? It's about, it's based on a true story of these two Syrian sisters who fled Syria and crossed the sea and almost drowned, and then one of them ended up being on that, do you remember, in I guess it was 2016, there was an Olympic refugee team in the Olympics of like refugees from all over the world, and she ended up competing on that team. Anyway, it's a really incredible film. It's called The Swimmers. And it really, there's just something about, I mean, it's based on a true story, and there's something about seeing what this group of refugees goes through to get from Syria to, they're trying to get to Germany, that like, oh my God, it's just all the things you know or like read about in the news in 2015 to actually see them play out is like,
wow,
really powerful. Yeah. I mean, there's this, yeah, there's this, so this long scene where they're trying to cross on a raft to get to Greece, and the raft is like way too small for the number of people they have, and they all think they're going to drown. And this really happened. She and her sister jumped off of the boat. So because it was taking on water and it was going to sink, and they actually jumped off the boat and, you know, spent hours in the sea so that everybody on the raft could make it to shore. And like, yeah, just the power of a time-based storytelling medium to show you what that really feels like or could feel like is incredible.
Is it, you say it's a documentary?
Or? It's not a documentary. No. It's a film based on a true story. It's really well done. Yeah. But it's heavy. You know, all the trigger warnings.
Oof. Yeah. I actually...
Okay, what about you, Rebecca? Oh, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to just say, I keep seeing the trailer for that and being like, yeah, is this the day? And then being like, I don't know.
yeah, I totally get that. The reason I clicked on it was it said it got a 4-minute standing ovation at some film festival. And I was like, okay, that seems worth watching. But I was like, no, I did not know.
Four minutes is not 6 minutes. I don't know if it's worth it.
I like that six is the cutoff. See, I would have gone with seven. You know, seven feels like a really round number to me. my glisten of the week is that I have found a pear tree that is within 10 minutes walking of where I am right now. And I love foraging. Here we are, taking it back, full circle, apricot tree in my childhood.
This is amazing.
I'm always, always like on the lookout for forageable fruits and vegetables. which probably comes from both like my desire to not spend money and also to like embrace the bounty of the earth. And yeah, I have this, there's this like amazing pear tree, and one of the pears fell to the ground the other day, and I brought it home and I washed it and I bit into it, and it was like pear squared pear, you know, like pear to the pear. In that, wow. Like, you know, when you, like, a lot of the time, honestly, like, an amazing pear is an amazing pear, but it's really hard to get a good pear.
Yeah.
And it's honestly, just at large, a lot of the time when we eat a piece of fruit, it's like, I feel like we're trying to chase that, like, sense of, like, oh, this is what it should taste like, you know? Mm. And this was, like, the most pure distillation of pear that I can remember having. I was like, ah, this is like from Mount Olympus, you know.
Wow.
So then the other day I went and I stood underneath the pear tree and I read it a poem, hoping it would then give me another pear, and it didn't. But
okay, what was the poem? What poem did you choose?
I chose Meditations in an Emergency by Cameron Awkward Rich.
Oh, I love them. I love their work. Ooh, okay, great.
I love that.
This is great.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit random. You know, I'm still working on it, but maybe they didn't, maybe the pear tree didn't like the, I don't know, whatever, who knows, but we'll see.
It takes a long time to make a pear.
It takes a really long time.
Maybe you just haven't given it enough time. Maybe you're going to have to wait another season. You know, it's going to have to internalize the poem, go through the winter, you know, make a new flower, have that flower be pollinated. And then, you know, a year from now, you might receive the pear that is the fruit of that poem.
Wow. Spoken by somebody who has...
Was it a short poem? Might be a small poem.
I know, it's like, am I reading at the Odyssey? What's happening? Bhagavad Gita, you know, it just is like, how long can we go on for? No, I love that. I love that, Sam. You would have that like holistic sense of seasons and time and energy passing through. I'm impatient, however, so.
Okay, well, do keep us posted.
I'll send you a photo of a pear if it happens, just out of the blue.
Okay. Perfect.
Pear time. Thank you so much, you two. This has been such a delight.
Thank you so much for coming on our show.
It's great to chat.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Beckett's Babies. If you enjoyed what you heard or learned a thing or two about playwriting, be sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast with your friends.
And if you'd like to reach out and share with us your thoughts on playwriting and theater, or maybe be a guest on the show, be sure to visit our website at www.beckettsbabies.com. That's www.beckettsbabies.com, and you can contact us there. Thanks for listening.